Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Moving away from our customary programming on Sundays, we'll be joining Jill Bevilacqua as she presents a program focusing on the spiritual writings of St. Francis, followed by a virtual visit to the Sistine Chapel where David and Goliath were once depicted by Michelangelo up high on the right-hand spandrel. In a few moments, you can hear this week's reflection on the Sunday Gospel, exceptionally presented this week by the rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome, Monsignor Philip Whitmore. But first, let's listen to this week's Gospel read for us by Chris Altieri.
When the days were completed for their purification according to the law of Moses, Mary and Joseph took Jesus up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, just as it is written in the law of the Lord. Every male that opens the womb shall be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer the sacrifice of a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons in accordance with the dictate in the law of the Lord. Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. This man was righteous and devout, awaiting the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he should not see death before he had seen the Christ of the Lord. He came in the Spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to perform the custom of the law in regard to him, he took him into his arms and blessed God, saying, "Now, Master, you may let your servant go in peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you prepared in the sight of all the peoples, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and glory for your people Israel."
And now we've listened to this week's Gospel, time to join Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Christians the world over mark this day by processing with lighted candles into the church to celebrate the presentation of the Lord in the temple, the moment when Mary and Joseph came with the child Jesus to make the offering prescribed by the law. It's a great festival of light. It harks back to Christmas because it marks 40 days from our Lord's birth, and it points forward to the Easter Vigil, when we process with candles once again, this time into a darkened church, as the light of the risen Christ spreads outwards, banishing the darkness of sin. Light and life. These wonderful gifts of God are centre stage in our celebration of Christmas and Easter. Christmas comes at the darkest point of the year, the dead of winter, and it reminds us that Christ, the light of the world, has come to drive away our darkness. Candlemas, the Feast of the Presentation, concludes the Christmas cycle, and it invites us to reflect on Christ as the light of the nations, lumen ad revelationem gentium, as Simeon puts it in his wonderful canticle of praise, the Nunc Dimittis, "Now, Lord, let your servant depart in peace." Light drives away darkness, it drives away ignorance, it drives away fear. When we were baptized, we were given a lighted candle, and we were told, or perhaps our parents and godparents were told, that we had been enlightened by Christ. We were to walk always as children of the light, and to keep the flame of faith alive in our hearts. And of course, we were to share that light with others. Christ himself told us not to hide our light under a bushel, but to put it on a stand, so that it gives light to everyone. We should remember this as we process with our lighted candles today. Our procession into the church on this feast reminds us to carry the light of Christ with us in our daily lives, so that he can truly be a light of revelation to the nations, to all those around us. Today we give thanks in a particular way for the gift of consecrated life. Just as Jesus in the temple was handed over to God as a sign that he belongs completely to the Father, so those who have been consecrated to God live lives of total dedication to him. Whatever the circumstances in which they live out their consecration, their radical poverty, chastity, and obedience are signs for the whole world of God's love for us and the total love that is called for in response. Their generous offering mirrors Christ's own offering, and it serves as a bright, shining light for the church and for the world. But all of us are called to spread the light of Christ through our lives, our words, our witness, our love. It was once said of Cardinal Basil Hume, who was Archbishop of Westminster at the end of the last century, that 1,000 light bulbs came on when he stepped into the room. Those are the words of Patrick Maguire, and the room he spoke of was his prison cell. Maguire had been wrongly convicted of terrorist crimes, but thanks to the Cardinal's tireless efforts, his conviction was eventually overturned, and he was released. What a beautiful image of the hope that a faithful Christian can bring to such a desperate situation. What an inspiration to us as we seek to bring light and life, joy and hope to those we meet on our journey. As we process with our lighted candles today, let's stop to think of the millions of Christians all over the world who are doing the same thing. And let's just imagine how different the world could be if all of us were to redouble our efforts to shine the light of Christ into the darkness of people's lives.
Warm thanks there to the rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome, Monsignor Philip Whittemore, for sharing with us this reflection. Jewel Bevilacqua will be back again with her series There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye at the same time next week. Meanwhile, let's join her for a programme focusing on the spiritual writings of St. Francis. It's part of a series by the title of Spiritual Writers, Spiritual Teachers, which shines the spotlight on men and women who brought Christianity to life in their own lives and works. St. Francis, then. Stay tuned.
Francis of Assisi, the one saint whom all succeeding generations have succeeded in canonizing, is probably the best-known saint in the whole calendar.
The 19th-century French Protestant writer Ernest Renan declared that after Jesus, he was the only perfect Christian. Pope Pius XI, in an encyclical celebrating the 7th centenary of the death of Francis, said the same.
Whether or not Francis was the one and only perfect Christian, comments biographer Abbe Engelbert, he was certainly the only Christian to take Christ quite literally at his word. No one else has ever dared to do so.
Perhaps Thomas Merton comes closest to the truth when he says, "Merely to know St. Francis is to understand the gospel, and to follow him in his true, integral spirit is to live the gospel in all its fullness."
Francis was born in Assisi around the year 1181. His father was a rich cloth merchant, and as a young man, Francis enjoyed wearing fine clothes and taking part in feasting and revelry with the other fashionable young men of the town.
But Assisi was not the peaceful place it is today. War, wrote Fortini, an historian and former mayor of Assisi, was the preferred occupation, the favourite passion of this town.
Francis grew up in the atmosphere of civil war, and like most young men of his acquaintance, he dreamed of going to war and winning glory and knighthood.
But a series of incidents in his life brought him gradually to another way of thinking. When he was about 20, Francis took part in a battle on the Tiber between neighbouring Perugia and his hometown. Perugia won, and Francis spent a year languishing in a Perugian prison.
This experience was followed by a serious illness, which left him listless and with a strange distaste for former joys. He returned to his customary occupations, including that of serving in his father's shop, but he still dreamed of war, and when the opportunity presented itself of fighting for the Pope,
he prepared himself excitedly.
Before he left home, Francis had a strange dream. He saw his house changed into a place full of weapons for war. A voice told him that these were all his, and that there would also be a bride for him to marry.
Francis took this to be an omen of his success in battle, and the next day he saddled his horse and set off to join the pontifical army in Apulia.
But he never got there. That night he stopped to rest at Spoleto, and there he had another dream. The same voice asked him where he was going. To the war, he replied eagerly.
And who will do better for you, the servant or the master? The master, answered Francis. Then why are you seeking the servant instead of the master? Lord, what do you wish me to do? Said Francis. Return to the place of your birth. There you will be told what you are to do.
From that moment, life changed for Francis. But it was not an easy conversion. He was not suddenly illuminated or told to found an order. It was a slow process. He prayed, he meditated. He retired to a cave outside the town and for a long time found no peace. Then he came out, radiantly happy. He had fallen in love. All the visions were now clear to him. His weapons were to be spiritual ones. His bride, the Lady Poverty.
But there were further steps to be taken along the road. Francis had always been generous, and he now dedicated himself to the poor, giving them food, money, and clothing.
Still, he was not yet one of them himself, and there was another test in store for him. In prayer, God had told him, "If you would find me, despise the things of this life, renounce yourself, and prefer bitterness to sweetness, for only thus can you come to full understanding."
Francis himself tells in his testament what the bitterness was that he had to prefer.
While I was in sin, it seemed very bitter to me to see lepers. And the Lord himself led me among them, and I had mercy upon them. And when I left them, that which seemed bitter to me was changed into sweetness of soul and body. And afterward I lingered a little and left the world.
Francis was riding his horse one day when he came face to face with a leper. His first instinct was to turn and flee, but then he remembered what he had been told. He got down off his horse and took the man in his arms, thrusting money into his hand. Next day, he went to the leper house and made friends with all the inmates, asking their pardon for having held them all in disgust.
Shortly afterwards, Francis was praying one day in the little ruined chapel of San Damiano. Suddenly, the figure of Christ on the crucifix called out to him, "Francis, go and repair my house, which, as you see, is falling into ruin."
Francis tended to take things literally, and on this occasion he believed he was to restore the church of St. Damian. Only later did he realize that God meant the whole church.
He rushed off home and took some of the richest bales of his father's cloth and rode off to Foligno, where he sold the lot, and his horse into the bargain, so that he had to walk 3 leagues home. He took the money to the priest at San Damiano, but the priest refused it, so Francis tossed the purse onto a window ledge in the church.
When his father heard, he was furious and locked his son up, but Francis' mother soon freed him, and he hid for a time outside the town. Then his father brought a law case against him, and Francis decided to put himself under the protection of the bishop.
Standing between his father and the bishop, in the presence of a huge crowd, Francis took off his fine clothes and laid them at his father's feet, declaring that now he wished to serve God, he would call only God his father. He had now cut all ties and was a free man.
One last incident served to show Francis the way his future lay. After San Damiano, he had restored other churches, and the last of these was the little chapel in the woods that was to be the hub of the Franciscan world, the Porziuncola, the little portion of land. It was while he was hearing Mass there one day that he heard the passage in the Gospel where Christ established the rule of conduct for his disciples.
"Go, preach, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers. Freely you have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither 2 coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves. For the workman is worthy of his meat. and into whatsoever city or town you shall enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and there abide till you go thence. And when you come into a house, salute it. And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it.
When the priest explained that this meant that the disciples of Christ had received the order to preach everywhere penitence, without carrying anything with them, and to depend on God alone to provide for their needs, Francis cried out, "This is what I wish. This is what I am seeking. This I long with all my inmost heart to do."
It was the final revelation. Now he had no more doubts. And from that moment on, until his death 18 years later, Francis did just that. He threw away his staff, his smart cloak, his shoes and his leather belt, leaving himself only a tunic which he tied with a cord and making himself a rough cloak.
It was not long before Francis was joined in his new life by other young men, and when the company had reached a round dozen, they went to Rome in the year 1210 to ask the Pope's blessing on their rule.
2 years later, a young girl named Claire left her family home to follow Francis, and so the poor Clares were established.
"Listen, little poor ones called by the Lord, who have come together from many parts and provinces. Live always in truth, that you may die in obedience. Do not look at the life outside, for that of the spirit is better. I beg you through great love to use with discretion the arms which the Lord gives you. Those who are weighed down by sickness, and the others who are wearied because of them, all of you, bear it in peace. For you will sell this fatigue at a very high price, and each one of you will be crowned queen in heaven with the Virgin Mary."
In his testament, written just a few weeks before his death, Francis tells how he and his first friars lived.
"And those who came to receive life gave to the poor everything which they were capable of possessing. And they were content with one tunic, patched inside and out, with a cord and short trousers. And we had no desire for anything more. We who were clerics used to say the office as other clerics did. The lay brothers said the Our Father, and we quite willingly stayed in churches. And we were simple and subject to all. And I used to work with my hands, and I still desire to work. And I firmly wish that all my brothers give themselves to honest work. Let those who do not know how to work learn, not from desire of receiving wages for their work, but as an example and in order to avoid idleness. And when we are not paid for our work, let us have recourse to the table of the Lord, seeking alms from door to door."
Francis forbade his friars to accept churches or houses not in conformity with holy poverty, and to accept only such hospitality as fits their profession as strangers and pilgrims on earth. Nor were they to accept the protection of pontifical favours.
Later, Francis' original intention was adapted by other people, and the friars began to live in houses, and the simple lifestyle of their founder was abandoned. Francis himself resigned the office of Minister General and lived his last years with a few devoted followers.
On Mount Laverna in 1224, he received the stigmata, the marks of Christ's passion, and 2 years later died in Assisi at the Porziuncola, the Franciscans' first home.
Francis was canonized only 2 years later.
And you were listening there to a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now, time to go on a virtual visit to the Sistine Chapel, where our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, helps us better understand Michelangelo's depiction of David and Goliath. So, Breda, we're going to speak about David and Goliath.
Yes.
In one of the spandrels of the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
It's obviously by Michelangelo.
It's up above the entrance to the Sistine Chapel. So these are the two scenes that you see up in the two corners. Like almost holding the ceiling together, stopping it from falling into the chapel. You you always get this sense when you look at these triangles, the four of them holding up all of the work on the top, at each end, at the four corners of the Sistine Chapel. So David and Goliath is one of the two that you can see as you enter. On the right-hand side you have David and Goliath, and the other side you have Judith. But we're going to talk here about David and Goliath. But they do have one thing in common, that they are a kind of a moral warning to those entering the chapel, because they are symbols of divine justice. So both, with their humility and wisdom and strength, serve the function of warning those of what can happen if the law of God is not observed. So there's a sort of prophetic sense here, and also the salvation of man coming through the Messiah because of the inhuman feats that they performed. Now, going back to David and Goliath, you have the war between the Philistines and the Israelites, and Goliath is looking for somebody to challenge him. The giant Goliath is looking for someone to challenge him in a duel. And of course, nobody wants to do this. So little David decides he's going to be brave and comes forward and manages to kill the giant. It's a strange scene. It's almost abstract in a way, because at the bottom part you see what could be a rock, brownish coloured rock, or certainly is the earth. You have the giant lying literally right across the scene, gigantic, obviously. And David is right above him in the act. He's in the act of cutting off his head, but he hasn't yet done so. So it's interesting. He grabs the giant by the hair. You can see his hand going into the hair and pulling at it, just to keep him under control. The giant is dressed in green, and the sleeves of his garment are a sort of an orange and white stripe. It's a very strange combination of colours there, actually. But I think it also helps to give more power to the scene, because those stripes, those little orange stripes, you can see in the tent also behind David. So there are certain links there. Your eye goes up one line and goes through David and goes into another line behind him. Now, the giant is falling down. David is dressed in blue and a green, which is like, it's a kind of gauge green in a sense, and very delicate green, whereas the colours worn by the giant are rougher, less finished colours, let's say. Then behind the two figures, you have this extraordinary tent, which is obviously the kind of tent you would have on normal battlefields anyway. But Michelangelo has painted it in such a way that it gives a kind of breath to the scene. It gives David a beautiful background, because the tent, the bottom part of the tent is white, and it curves around. And it goes into, it's going into another triangle. It's almost like the tent itself will become a triangle, even though you can't see the top of the tent, which is outside the painting, let's say. And then you can see the orange part on the top with the lines, and you can get the feeling that there's a light inside the tent. So this is all helping to illuminate David in the moment when he is about to cut the head off the giant. Now, hidden in the back, on each side, behind the ground or rock or whatever, are the soldiers who are looking on in disbelief and horror. That how can this possibly be happening? So they're absolutely amazed. Michelangelo manages to do a lot of this work without doing too much detail. It's extraordinary the way you have, for example, the face of David has a lot of detail. And you can really see his expression and his concentration. His clothes are also very detailed. The giant, you can't see his face, but his hair is very detailed and the light is falling on his head. So that means that anybody looking at this piece from the ground will see that David is grabbing his hair. So you don't have any doubt as to what's happening there. Then Michelangelo has painted one of the hands of the giant, almost like it's just like an abstract piece, just a shape. But it's not a detailed hand. The other hand is very detailed. And again, you look at the feet of the giant, the one foot that you can actually see. Again, it's very chunky and not particularly detailed either. The soldiers, the ones on the right-hand side, are very clearly defined. The ones on the left, not so. You get the feeling that the scene goes around inside. He has been able to create a sense of space that you can imagine the space that's beyond the space that he's painting in. The whole story of this, obviously, is the triumph of good over evil. Which obviously is the entire message of the Sistine Chapel. It's the entire message of the Old and New Testament. This is where Michelangelo is able to let us in to his way of explaining the theology of the body through his attempts at trying to express with visual figure God's message to us.
And you were listening there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome. Our thanks go to her. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. So be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.